Brent crude prices surged above $70 a barrel for the first time since January 2020, that following a Yemeni drone and a ballistic missile attack on Saudi oil facilities. Lebanese demonstrators block roads on the seventh day of rallies against the financial crisis the country is grappling with. And in the UK, Meghan Markle, the wife of Prince Harry, accuses the British royal family of racism. Hi, this is World News from Tehran. I'm Mehrouz Najafi. Good to have you with us. Starting with a top story, oil prices have jumped significantly, and that after Saudi Arabia confirming a Yemeni drone and missile attack on its oil facilities inside the Arab Kingdom. Brent crude oil surged more than 2% to above $70 a barrel in the Monday trade. That's the highest price since January 2020. And the surge came after Saudi Energy Ministry confirmed that a drone hit a petroleum tank farm at Ras Tanura, one of the world's largest oil shipping ports. The minister said a ballistic missile also targeted Aramco facilities in the city of Tehran. The Yemeni army said earlier that it had targeted Saudi oil facilities with 14 drones and 8 ballistic missiles. Now, journalist and political analyst Yusuf Mauri says that the target of the Yemeni attacks on Saudi Arabia is its economy, not the Saudi people.
Tens of thousands of Yemenis and hundreds of thousands more who have starved to death due to the strangling blockade on Yemen's economy. And this is a case, I think, where Yemenis are dealing with a bully. And like all bullies, they're not going to stop the bullying unless they get punched in the nose. And I think this is what the Yemeni people are coming to realize. So, latest attacks are in accordance with the Yemeni army's retaliatory attacks, which is aimed specifically at targeting Saudi Arabia's most precious jewel, which is Aramco oil. Ansar Allah, they believe that if they continue to target Saudi Arabia's economy, then that will, the end game will be Saudi Arabia will put up the white flag and say, no more, we want an end to the war, because now the war is, you know, the tables are turning. And the tables will start to turn, and Saudi Arabia's economy will suffer in the future if this war continues. Their reputation is already tarnished, and if this war continues, more military sites of Saudi Arabia are going to be targeted, and their economy will continue to suffer.
Now, Tehran has denounced as shameful the situation in Yemen, calling for an end to the Saudi-led aggression against the country. Foreign Ministry spokesman Said Khatibzadeh says that the current disaster in Yemen is rooted in the six-year-long war imposed on that country by Saudi Arabia and its allies. Khatibzadeh says that the coalition is even making use of terrorist elements in Yemen to advance its hostile policies. He was referring to a recent report by Yemen intelligence services that Al-Qaeda-linked terrorists assist Saudi-backed forces in the country. Khatibzadeh said that Iran has repeatedly emphasized on a ceasefire and the removal of a Saudi-imposed blockade to end the crisis. Now, in the meantime, Yemeni medical workers have staged a demonstration before the UN office in Sana'a. They slammed the continued seizure of oil vessels by the Saudi-led coalition, which has led to the closure of many medical facilities. Abdul Latif al-Mashali has the story.
Hundreds of medical workers have gathered in front of the United Nations office in the capital Sana'a. They denounced the international community for turning a blind eye on the continued seizure of oil ships by the Saudi-led coalition, which has put the war-torn country to a severe fuel crisis.
I suffer from kidney failure and I have to travel 50 kilometers to get to the dialysis center despite the lack of fuel. I need dialysis 3 times a week, but I only get one because of the blockade on our country. We call on the international organizations to stand by our side and help us to get the fuel in order to save our lives.
The Ministry of Health said over 1,500 medical facilities, including dialysis centers, are on the verge of total shutdown due to the lack of fuel. The ministry has urged the international community to step in and to pressure the Saudi-led coalition to release the seized oil tankers. The United Nations says the Saudi war on Yemen, along with the years-long blockade, has driven the country into the world's worst humanitarian crisis.
Thousands of patients, including children, may lose their lives within days unless the international community breaks its silence and pressures Saudi Arabia to release the illegally detained oil vessels. Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Now turning to Lebanon, dozens of demonstrators have hit the streets on the seventh day of protests against the country's financial crisis and political paralysis. Demonstrators burned tires and blocked main roads all over the country. They also briefly blocked the main road in front of the central bank. Political leaders in the country have failed to agree to a rescue plan since the crisis erupted in late 2019 when the dollar inflows dried up. That's why Prime Minister-designate Saad Hariri, who was nominated in October, has failed to form a new cabinet due to a political deadlock with President Michelon. Caretaker Prime Minister Hassan Diab has threatened to resign to pressure the politicians to form a new government. It's such a mess, unfortunately, in Lebanon. So from Beirut, the Lebanese capital, let's bring in our correspondent, Mariam Saleh, and see what she has to tell us. Mariam, you know government, actually, and this recent threat by Mr. Diab. And then you also have more than a week of protest rallies going on, and God knows how much longer it will go on. Tell us more about the situation there.
Yes, exactly. Well, you have several issues here playing out. First of all, we have the price of the dollar, which is extremely high. It's been rising slowly, bit by bit. Now we have the peak, which is we're talking about 10,000 Lebanese lira facing a dollar. And that is, originally it was 1,500. So this is why you have this slow deterioration of the situation. But what we are witnessing right now is a total collapse, if we may say, of the entire state. Not just the government, it's not just the issue of formation of the cabinet. We're talking about the entire state institutions, about everything. And the fact of the matter that we have here a transformation point, this is the turning point, the fact that we've reached that high with the price of the dollar. But on the other side, you have those groups that are in power. They are the ones who are protecting the head of the central bank, who is considered to be one of the main responsible sides for the collapse of the Lebanese lira. Now, that is on one side. On the other side, you have the formation of the cabinet. You also have a lot of issues that play out, and the complexity of the matter doesn't allow you to see, perhaps clearly, what we can tell from analysis. Like, for example, we're witnessing right now blockage of roads. Of this the supporters that are blocking roads are supporters of the former political elite, or the current political elite, if you may say. Those who have been in power for over 30 years. We're talking about supporters of the Falangists, the Lebanese forces, we're talking about this, the Progressive Socialist Party, and so on. And all of them seem to have one main slogan, which is taking down President Michelon. Everyone is blaming President Michelon, and this is considered to be, I mean, quite ironic, because he has not been in power. He's not the one who was in power for over 30 years. But there is one thing that President Ton has been calling for, which is forensic audit. And that seems to be the key term. Forensic audit would put a lot of people in power, either in jail or at least take them to court. And this is what everybody has been waiting for. This is what we want. We want to see the corrupt. We want to see what happened with all the money, with the institutions, with the how corruption has been dealt with, how they have been corrupt inside the Lebanese institutions. And we're talking about the prime ministers, the former prime ministers, the current, if we may say, prime minister designate also, who has been considered to be one of the accused, and even those who have been in power as the head of the parliament, all the former, if we may say, members of parliament as well. So you have, and even former ministers, of course, all of them should be under that forensic audit, and all of them are resisting that point specifically. You only have mainly Hezbollah, you have the Free Patriotic Movement, and you have President Michelon, who are really pushing for forensic audit. It was Prime Minister designate, it was Prime Minister caretaker, Prime Minister Hassani Diab, who actually began with the forensic audit. They called to begin with that. And once that happened, you had all this resistance from the political elites. And this is what we're seeing right now. So the blockage of votes, the votes being blocked are mostly being blocked by supporters of that elite that is not only just trying to protect Salami, who has had a central bank, but also trying to protect that corrupt political elite, unfortunately. And those who are silent, unfortunately, they're silent, but there doesn't seem to be a plan for the other side, who do want to see the corrupt being tried in court and at the same time bring the situation to some sort of a solution. So I don't know if you can see how complex the situation is here in Lebanon.
Yeah, pretty complex. And this is time for unity and not for disunity, unfortunately. Thank you very much for that, Maryam Saleh in Beirut. Now, the United States says that all options are on the table for the remaining troops in Afghanistan as it's facing a May 1st deadline to evacuate the forces out of that country. The State Department spokesman says that the U.S. has not made any decision about its posture in Afghanistan after the due date. The deadline was set in an agreement signed by the Taliban militant group and the Trump administration in Qatar in 2020. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken says Washington is considering the full withdrawal of forces along with other options. Blinken made the comments in a letter to the Afghan president. He also called for a 90-day reduction in violence in the country and a new international peace effort to be overseen by the U.N. Blinken, however, warned that a troop withdrawal may worsen the security condition in Afghanistan. Now, that is while the controversial intra-Afghan talks in Qatar is reaching its final day. So far, they have failed to even reduce the level of violence in Afghanistan. In the meantime, the U.S. is calling for the creation of an interim government. Our correspondent Amin Alami has a report from capital Kabul.
It's been almost 6 months since the first intra-Afghan talks in the Qatari capital Doha, but so far, no viable agreement has been reached. The situation in Afghanistan has now become so complicated that the Afghan president is agreeing to hold an early election.
We stand ready to discuss holding free, fair, and inclusive elections under the auspices of the international community. We can also talk about the date of the elections and reach a conclusion.
Ashraf Ghani, however, strongly rejected a U.S. plan to form an interim government. The Afghan president said the only legitimate way to gain political power in Afghanistan is through elections.
Any institution can write a fiction on a piece of paper and suggest a solution for Afghanistan. These papers have been written in the past and will be written in the future. Our guarantee is our constitution.
President Ghani's comments came after calls for forming an interim government in Afghanistan increased in the past couple of months. This is why the U.S. Special Representative Zalmay Khalilzad met some top prominent political leaders, tribal elders, and other influential figures during his recent visit to Kabul. The meetings soon faced mixed reactions. Many here say the main agenda of Khalilzad is to convince the Afghan president to accept an interim government and hold another round of talks in Turkish capital Ankara.
This is clear that Khalilzad wants to put pressure on both the Afghan government and the Taliban to approve an interim government. President Ghani's reaction also means that he is not ready to accept whatever Washington wants.
While the Afghan government brands the establishment of any interim government as the death of democracy in Afghanistan, President Ghani's yes to an early election is considered as a green light for the Taliban to join a democratic process in order to gain power. Now, only time will tell whether or not the Taliban, the Afghan government, and the U.S. can make a comprehensive agreement or not. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
The U.S. and South Korea have reached an agreement under which Seoul accepts to increase its funding for U.S. military troops stationed in that country. The six-year deal replaces a similar accord which expired in 2019. Under the previous agreement, Seoul had been paying Washington some $920 million a year. Both sides have avoided specifying the agreed amount for the new deal. Seoul has been paying the U.S. for its troop presence since early 1990s. The two nations have also started their 9-day annual military exercise. Some 28,500 American troops are stationed in the country to defend it against possible threats from its nuclear-armed neighbor, North Korea. In a bombshell interview with a U.S. news broadcaster, Meghan Markle, the wife of British Prince Harry, has revealed the prevailing racism in the monarchy that she experienced after joining the royal family.
So we have in tandem the conversation of he won't be given security, he's not going to be given a title, and also concerns and conversations about how dark his skin might be when he's born.
Sitting next to Harry, Meghan was referring to official concerns about the appearance of her unborn son and the security that he would be entitled to. She said the family refused to make Archie a prince, partly due to conversations about how dark his skin might be. Meghan also complained about Kate Middleton, the wife of Prince William, saying that she made her cry before the wedding over flower girl dresses. She also talked about Harry's rift with his father. And Harry said that his experience with Meghan showed how hard it must have been for his deceased mother, Diana. A fresh anti-coup protests have erupted in several cities across Myanmar following a call for a general strike. Two demonstrators were reportedly killed by gunshot wounds in a northern city. It's not clear who fired at the protesters. The demonstrations came after an appeal by 18 trade unions for mass walkouts. The aim of the strikes is to economically pressure the military into reversing its seizure of power. Calls to shut down the economy came after another weekend of violent clashes between protesters, police, and the military. More than 50 people have been killed, nearly 1,800 arrested since the army took over the elected government on February the 1st. At least 15 people have been killed in a series of large explosions at a military base in the city of Bata in Equatorial Guinea. President Teodoro Obiang says that some 500 people were also injured in that incident. On national television, Obiang stressed that the blasts were caused by negligence related to the use of dynamite at the base. Local media have urged people to donate blood while noting that hospitals in the region were overwhelmed. The blast comes as Equatorial Guinea, an oil producer, is suffering a double economic shock because of the COVID-19 pandemic and a drop in the prices of crude, which provides around 3/4 of the state revenue. Ivory Coast ruling party and the main opposition have both claimed victory in legislative elections, with the full results still to be announced. A senior member of the ruling party says that they have achieved their goal of securing some 60% of the seats. The top opposition party, however, says it has grabbed more than 50% of the seats. The opposition party also alleges that preliminary results were strewn with fraud, tampering, and manipulation. Observers estimate turnout to be only 20%, citing fears of violence in the former French colony. The parliamentary vote is a key test of the stability 4 months after violence over the presidential vote. Clashes claimed some 90 lives in the West African nation. That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent. Our program today is about India and its northern neighbor, China. We'll try to explore the issues, dissect them, analyze them, and discuss them with our experts. Please stay with us.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we are going to talk about the recent Sino-Indian agreement for simultaneous withdrawal of military forces from disputed border areas in the heights of Himalayas. Then we throw more light on the magnitude of the disengagement deal and its consequence for the geopolitics of Asia and the entire world.
Last year was a difficult one for Sino-Indian ties. Their militaries had several bouts of deadly skirmishes in border areas on the backdrop of the saber-rattling by their authorities. But the mood along the border seems to be changing following the recent deal between New Delhi and Beijing. They agreed on a simultaneous withdrawal process that can herald a durable detente between the two nuclear-armed neighbors of South Asia.
The relations between India and China go back deep in the history, but in modern days, ties have been politically tense with occasional strategic cooperation. Relationship between President Xi Jinping and Premier Narendra Modi were warming considerably until 2020, which was markedly a bloody year for the two countries. It was decades the Himalayan border lines hadn't been the scene of such hot strings of deadly clashes. Their border disputes were militarized for ages and they had inked numerous ineffective deals over the years. But last year's skirmishes and the resulting loss of lives provoked more complex responses. This meant strategic maneuvers and movements of military forces and machinery in the extremely hazardous ranges of Himalaya.
If you look at this disengagement, and let's assume there is a peaceful, stable control of the border area, that will be in the benefit of both the Chinese side and the Indian side, as well as the regional countries. Probably Pakistan and other countries will potentially benefit from a stable relationship between Beijing and New Delhi. Of course, there are other countries who probably don't like to see the stable management of this border area. For example, Washington, we know their big strategy or geopolitical calculation is to use India as a tool against China. If there's no problem, if there's a good and a stable relationship that is to be established between Beijing and New Delhi, and then Washington will find it hard probably to make good use of New Delhi against Beijing.
Perhaps this was when they came to realize for war in such altitudes, they need to update each other's maps of border lines before further actions. To be able to accuse each other of crossing the line, they had to match their understanding of the line. The recent agreement for simultaneous disengagement basically means India and China decided that it is best they pull out their troops from the contentious regions until they find ways to better comprehend the realities on the ground. Historically, better interaction has built more bridges than walls.
China does not to have India as an enemy or as a potential rival. China would love to resolve the disputes with India. China would love to put the relationship back on track and then, boost the bilateral exchanges and have a better understanding and diffuse all the tensions between the two countries. In that way, China would love to see a more peaceful and stable neighborhood that will strengthen, that will be the strength of the Chinese interests, that will be in the interest of the Chinese strategic consideration, let's say.
India and China have long-lasting conflicts in the heights of the Himalayas, almost all of them over their territorial claims along the border. Their different delineations of the border areas and understanding of border lines have even further obscured the situation in the foggy mountain ranges. In some places, the patrolling forces simply don't know the protocol for response upon confronting the other country's forces. They just start a stare contest and wait for the first move by the other soldiers. Shedding light to the dark valleys of uncertainty, the recent deal may be able to better maintain the silence of the mounts.
The root cause of India-China border disputes is the definition of the demarcation line, an imprecise 3,500 kilometer line that spans through rivers, lakes, and snow caps along the frontier means the line can shift across the landscapes, and confrontation sparks at points where patrolling soldiers come face to face. The Pangong Lake in Ladakh is one of those areas. This new deal is different because it explicitly acknowledges that a grey area or no man's land has existed between the two countries' conflicting definitions of the Line of Actual Control, LAC. Moreover, it formally changed the status of this area to a buffer zone. Before the designation of a buffer zone, both Chinese and Indian forces had frequent patrols in the disputed areas, while waving placards that reiterated their claim over the territory, asking each other to withdraw. Now, neither side will enter it till the misunderstandings are cleared through talks. According to the accord, Chinese troops have started clearing the north bank of the Pangong Lake, while the disengagement is still ongoing by both sides on some parts of the north and south banks. If the phases of the withdrawal go on as planned, the deal will serve as a model for similar processes all along the line.
So it's really up to not only to the Chinese side, but also to the Indian side to see if they have this wisdom and determination to maintain a stable control of their dispute over the border issue. But the one thing we can say that is, I guess neither side want to have the dispute somehow to monopolize their relationship, to define this bilateral relationship, or to become the top agenda between the two countries.
Many experts have predicted that by mid-21st century, Asia will outstrip the West and reclaim its place as the world's dominant economic force. For such a scenario to ever happen, these two Asian economic and political powerhouses should grow increasingly closer. The recent deal for simultaneous disengagement by India and China in the heights of the Himalayas is among the first pieces of the domino.
The recent disengagement deal has created a de facto no-clash belt that is definitely distinct from a de jure border line. This has the potential to finally bring the lasting peace that both have been seeking ever since they signed the Agreement on the Maintenance of Peace and Tranquility in 1993. The full story of how such historic breakthrough was accomplished is not available now. Maybe decades later, if ever, the official documents get declassified, but the magnitude of this achievement is undeniable. Not driven or reinforced by any overt intervention of populist politicians, the agreement emerged almost entirely out of intense but effective interaction between the military commands of the two countries. Through creating a buffer zone around Pangong, the military commands of India and China managed to take the first essential step to provide the appropriate ground and discourse for the settlement of this seven-decade-long problem based on a new concept of an international border.
This is really about the long-term China and India relationship here. It's not only about this border dispute. I believe the two sides will continue to talk to each other about the border disputes over there. Remember one fact, you know, China has 14 countries, bordering 14 countries on the land, and 12 of them have resolved the border issues with China. The only two remaining basically is India and Bhutan, Bhutan which is under control of India. So basically there's only one country, that's India. So the Chinese side would say, you know, there is a lack of flexibility on the Indian side. You know, of course, there are probably, you know, Indian allegations about the Chinese side. But anyway, I think both sides understand that their relationship should not be defined by the border disputes. Because for both sides, their priority is really the development of the economy and the welfare of their people. And that's, you know, much more important than a piece of barren land in the Himalaya along this high plateau over there.
although the problems between India and China are not limited to the border issues, the mere existence of a functioning de-escalation process and an ongoing interaction have promising prospects for a continental peace, on top of the drastic consequences for the domestic and foreign politics of the two countries. Cordial relations between India and China can change the dynamics of ties in the region and the globe simultaneously. For starters, Pakistan feels the need to readjust its India strategy accordingly, while China gains even more leverage against the already benign policy of the Biden administration.
India and China are two old neighboring empires that together account for nearly 40% of the total population of the earth. Anything in this world that involves the lives of so many people has spiraling repercussions for all the international society. When there were clashes at the border and trade wars in the market, Beijing and New Delhi had reasons to justify failures and silence the critics. Now, with relative calm in the Himalayas, the internal opposition has more room to grow. The agreement has myriads of different advantages and perhaps disadvantages, particularly for countries with more direct connections. Following the disengagement deal, Pakistan also moved to reach a ceasefire with India over somehow similar border issues.
I think, you know, let's say a trustful and a stable relationship between New Delhi and Beijing that will ultimately help resolve the tension or the problems over Kashmir and the relationship between Pakistan and India. Of course, you know, from Indians' point of view, they would see, China is behind Pakistan against India. But as I said, for China would love to see Pakistan and India resolve their disputes, you know, historical issues over Kashmir and other issues, the lack of trust between the two countries. What's the point of fighting against each other? Because neither Pakistan and India would benefit from a bad relationship between the two countries. I don't think India wants to have a very tense relationship or very tense, you know, flashpoints, not only with China, but also with Pakistan. For China would love to see its disputes with India to be resolved, and also would love to see the disputes between Pakistan and India to be resolved very soon. China would love to play a role. I know India does not welcome a third country to play any role between its relationship with another country, but still, China at least can, you know, encourage Pakistan to be brave and to reach an agreement, a rapprochement with India. In that sense, everybody benefits from that kind of situation.
In addition, more nuanced and less harsh China policies by the Biden administration means India has to rely on itself to contain a Beijing who now enjoys greater leeway.
Washington would not love to see an improved relationship between New Delhi and Beijing, including this engagement. I would say probably that's the reaction from Washington. But of course, you know, diplomatically, they would welcome such an disengagement. But strategically, I don't think people welcome that kind of development. But also, I think in New Delhi, they have a tradition of non-alliance in their policy making. They have they cherish their independent foreign policy very much. So they would love to have a relationship based on their own interests in terms of, relationship with Beijing, in terms of relationship with Washington or Moscow or with any other countries. So for India, for their national interests, they would love to have a stable relationship with China. They would welcome more foreign investment from either Beijing or Moscow or Washington, because that serves the national interests of India. Although it's not exactly in the interest of Washington, because Washington would love to see India to take a long-term, hard confrontation with Beijing. In that way, they can say, we are with you, India, and go against China. But I think the India side, they are much, much wider than that. They are much wider than, to be used as a tool in geopolitical competition.
The looming changes in India and China's relations with each other, as well as the world, can even have more dramatic outcomes, with the potential power to usher in a paradigm shift in the geopolitics of Asia and the world.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
All right, to learn more about this issue, we are joined by Mr. William Jones, who is the executive at Intelligence Review. Mr. Jones, welcome to the show. So starting off, I would like to ask you, can the India-China border dispute be resolved peacefully? And are India and China close to something like a lasting peace?
Well, I think the border dispute can be resolved. I think it'll take a little more longer time than one would like. But I think what they have come to now in resolving some of the immediate hostility from the earlier period, they can begin to talk about these things. I don't think there's an inevitable conflict between India and China. I think they will get along and can get along if outside influences don't tip the scale here. So I'm very optimistic that they'll move forward on this.
Intervention is certainly a big issue. So can this peace deal be the first step towards building a strong Asian bloc, and who will benefit from such a peace deal?
Well, building a strong Asian bloc is not going to happen anytime soon, given the tensions between India and China, and given the policies of the West, particularly the United States, with its Indo-Pacific strategy, which is specifically designed to contain China. I think the first step in moving in the direction of a united Asia is to try and counter this type of strategy by getting the countries of the region to work closer together, and really to reject any kind of overt attempt to contain China, which is the most important country economically and also to some extent politically in the region. But you would have a strong Asia. If India and China collaborate together, there would be peace in Asia. But it's going to take a while because of their own dynamic and because of the outside forces that are trying to push it in a different direction.
All right, Mr. Jones, before moving ahead, please let's just take a quick look at the global media coverages regarding this issue.
Through the last decade, China has constructed proper surfaced roads on its side and has been able to access the area with vehicles, while Indian soldiers reached it by foot. In 2016 to 2017, the government purchased new patrol boats to ensure that access to Finger 8 from the lake could be improved. Meanwhile, all eyes are on how China will execute its withdrawal, dismantling all that it has built. So far, the ground reports are positive in what it is to be a four-phase withdrawal process. Indian Foreign Secretary Harshvardhan Shringla has said that the economic relationship between India and China has to be calibrated based on the progress on important issues that are critical to both countries politically. We, in our interactions with our Chinese interlocutors, have always made the point that a normal bilateral relationship is contingent upon peace and tranquility in the border areas, he said. A prolongation of the existing situation was not in the interest of either side, India's foreign ministry said in a statement, citing the conversation between Foreign Minister S. Jaishankar and China's Wang Yi. Jaishankar said that once disengagement is completed at all friction points, then the two sides could also look at a border de-escalation of troops in the area and work towards restoration of peace and tranquility. To a generation that has grown up in the era of the nation-state, this will look like an unsatisfactory resolution of the issue, for don't all countries need hard, clearly defined, constantly patrolled borders? What our generation can only learn from the study of history is that hard boundaries replaced porous border regions or belts only in the era of the nation-state, which first took shape after the Treaty of Westphalia in 1648 and attained its full malignant form with the widespread introduction of passports as recently as in the 1880s.
Welcome back, Mr. Jones. So, continuing on, China has been effective and more efficient than India in moving its forces towards the Himalayas in the disputed region. Can this mean that it is a tactic by China to make India withdraw its forces and then restation its forces into a better strategic reconfiguration? Do you think that is the case?
I don't think that is the case. China, of course, will always keep an eye on the situation with regard to its borders. They're very important for them. But I think the fundamental thrust of the Chinese policy is they would like to have a working relationship with India. They do not want to be at loggerheads. These are the two most important countries in Asia. They are both ancient civilizations, as is emphasized by Chinese leaders all the time. And if they come together, the whole region will come to a peaceful solution. But if they're at loggerheads, it's going to be trouble for both of the parties. So I don't think there's any kind of devious intent in what is happening now, but I think a real intent to try and create, at least for the moment, a temporary peace and hopefully a permanent peace between these two great Asian giants.
All right, so how will the U.S. respond or react to this peace between India and China?
Well, if India gets close to China in terms of politically or even militarily, the U.S. would probably do everything to sabotage that. I don't think the U.S. really wants a conflict between India and China, but they do want India as a party in an overall plan to contain China. But I think if India, for its own reasons and in its own interest, decides that it does not want to be a part of anything that looks like a military pact or even a political pact aimed against China, I think the United States will accept that, even though they would not be very happy about it. But I think if it gets too close, there'll be attempt to sabotage, because there is a full court press at the present moment to try and bring India on board this Quad arrangement, which some people in Washington, I think, see this as a possible buildup of an Asian NATO. I don't think that would be acceptable by India, and at a certain point, I think they're going to have to just say no to it.
All right, this marks the end of this session. Thank you, Mr. Jones, for being with us. Let's take a quick look at the social media coverages in this regard.
Snehesh Alex Philip on his Twitter said, Army Chief says China realized its habit of creeping forward and achieving goal without firing a shot or suffering casualties will not work with India. Says disengagement is win-win for both countries. Adds India does not want unsettled borders. Zeba Warsi wrote on her Twitter, Sonia Gandhi in today's CWC, India has been hit by a terrible economic crisis, a pandemic of huge proportions, and now by a full-blown crisis on the borders with China. Much of each crisis is attributable to the mismanagement of the BJP government and the wrong policies pursued by it. Tony Ashai posted on his Twitter, this video shows how sensitive Kashmir issue is. Kashmir borders with India, Pakistan and China, all three nuclear-capable countries. In the middle of this lies the future of 12 million poor Kashmiris who have no voice. One miscalculation and we have a nuclear holocaust.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, that was our episode covering the deal between China and India to simultaneously withdraw the military forces on the Himalayan region. We'll meet next week.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents.
The first type of right that Imam Sajjad alayhi salam speaks about in his treatise is the right of God, the right of Allah, Haqqullah.
For Humanity, a commentary on Risalatul Huquq of Imam Sajjad alayhi salam.
In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, welcome to IRIB English Radio and the program for humanity. I'm Sayyid Wahid Alawi and I greet you with the greetings of Islam. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. We were talking about one of the rights of the book, the Treatise of Rights, from Imam Sajjad, Imam Ali Zainul Abidin, the great grandchild of the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam, Haqqul Mustashir. And as previously said, we were going through the art of giving advice, because not everyone is born with those skills, and surely you need those skills when you give advice. And as I mentioned earlier, at least 13 times in the Noble Quran, advice in giving advice or seeking advice has been mentioned. The tips that I gave in previous programs, I will go through it very fast and go straight to the point, which was tip number 15 and forward. Number one, examine your motives, your intention. Number two, be sensitive about how to bring up a subject. Number three, avoid giving advice in the form of reprimand. Number four, keep privacy whenever you give advice. Number five, always ask permission for giving advice. Number six, listen first. Number seven, consider the other's frame of mind. Number eight, offer advice without insisting. Number nine, avoid making judgments. And number 10, avoid threatening people when you give advice. Number 11, be specific and brief when you give advice. Number 12, avoid compelling others to follow your advice. Number 13, give advice as an act of worship, not as a habit. Number 14, show some humility when you give advice. And we reached tip number 15 in the etiquette and the art of giving advice. And number 15 is practice what you preach. That is a key rule which should always be in our lives. The one who grants advice to his brother in matters of faith and concerns himself with mending affairs of his own life has granted an excellent gift and fulfills an obligation that was due on him. Further, he that gives good advice builds with one hand. He that gives good counsel, an example, builds with both. But he that gives good admonition and bad example builds with one hand and pulls down with the other. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, it is most hateful to Allah that you should say that which you do not do. And brothers and sisters, we should be very, very careful here, because here we have the issue of nifaq and hypocrisy sneaking in within our hearts when we do not practice what we say. We don't walk the talk. All right, we're going to go for a break. Please join us after the break.
Dear listeners, you are listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, dear listeners, to IRIB English Radio and the program For Humanity. And we were talking about the etiquette of giving advice from the treaties of rights and the right, specifically the right of the one who seeks advice, Haqqul Mustashir. And we reached tip number 16. Consider misunderstanding. Be aware always of the fact that advice is not always well received. Giving an advice requires a great deal of patience and devotion in case the person you are advising attacks you verbally or even physically. You should never return the harm. Number 17, be kind and gentle. It is narrated from the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alihi wasallam, gentleness is not to be found in anything but that it adds to its beauty, and it is not withdrawn from anything but it makes it defective. Thus, one ought to be gentle and kind while giving an advice. Such method is agreed upon between all religions and cultures. Some people say that advice is like snow. The softer it falls, the longer it dwells upon, and the deeper it sinks into the mind. I will mention it one more time. Advice is like snow. The softer it falls, the longer it dwells upon, and the deeper it sinks into the mind. Finally, it is important to mention that giving advice is an essential trait of a Muslim character. A Muslim should always be ready to give genuine advice to his fellow brother or sister. And it is also narrated from Jarir ibn Abdullah, companion to the Prophet, I came to the Prophet and declared, I pledge my allegiance to you in Islam. The Prophet said, on condition that you pray, give charity, and offer advice. Jarir then said, I thus pledged my oath of allegiance to the Prophet and to Islam. May Allah's peace and blessings be upon this Prophet, Muhammad al-Mustafa, who gave such a blessed advice to all of us Muslims to have in all of our lives. On condition that you pray, give charity, and offer advice, he says to this companion, Jarir ibn Abdullah. That's all for today's program, dear brothers and sisters. You can contact us and please forward your questions to our email address, which is englishradio@irib.ir. And you can also listen to us in parstoday.com. Parstoday.com. Till next time, may Allah's peace and blessings be upon all of you.
صل يا ربي على طه الأمين رحمة أرسلته للعالمين وعلى آل النبي أجمعين فبهم نرجوك أحسن ختمنا
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. This is I